Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. We hope you are getting through Mid-Michigan's latest weather emergency. The latest in a series, it would appear. We hope you're getting through this as smoothly as can be expected. Coming up, in addition to Chad Gamble and George Lahana speaking on behalf of the city of Lansing and the city of East Lansing, respectively, keep in mind, as you heard a minute ago on NPR, the big concern now is frigid weather, the likes of which, I mean, some of the numbers I've heard have been extraordinary. Kevin Lavery was reporting this morning on Morning Edition, wind chills 20 to 30 below zero are not out of the question for Michigan. That is obviously the big concern now with the snowfall out of the area. And we've also lined up Joan Jackson Johnson, who's director of the City of Lansing's Department of Human Relations and Community Services, to talk about warming centers and the situations that people are going to face if they should lose heat. I can't even imagine that on the heels of the ice storm and as much discomfort as everybody endured, hardship they endured in that to face temperatures like this without power. Hopefully it won't be an issue, but we'll talk with Joan about that here in just a little bit. It has been a stimulating 12 to 24 hours for our first guest. Chad Gamble is the City of Lansing's COO and Director of Public Services, and we welcome him back to Current State. Hi, Chad.
Good morning, Mark. Stimulating is certainly one word you could use.
It was the best all-purpose word that I could find to probably describe your life for the last 12 to 24 hours. Tell us where the city stands right now in the aftermath of this storm from your perspective. Are you facing any particular challenges providing key services?
Well, we've done, I think, the City of Lansing team has done a tremendous job of, again, reacting to another one of these winter storms that seemingly we're set to get here over the next couple of months. We started plowing very early on Saturday evening, and we've basically continued winter operations with approximately 25 public service team members around the clock, making sure that we can hit this event as hard as we possibly can. And we have been very successful in doing that. The mayoral declaration of a snow emergency has certainly helped us mass our staffing to maximize our plowing capabilities. We have, as of this time, Mark, been able to clear most, if not all, of the major streets. We are now very soon going to be entering into the local streets and working our way through the city to get what is approximately 15 inches of snow cleared away from the locals so that they can now make it to the major streets. Mm.
What key pieces of information or advice, then, do you have as we speak right now, Chad, for Lansing residents?
Well, the mayoral declaration, Mayor Bonero declared a snow emergency, and it started a couple things kind of cascading from there. One of the things I wanted to highlight is until we are able to get into your neighborhood, we would certainly encourage people to stay put. The travel in local streets, unless you have a four-wheel drive vehicle, is very challenging. In addition to that, we would certainly request that people do not park their vehicles on the street. The snow emergency has caused us to begin towing any vehicle that is now parked in the roadway. The plows will find it very difficult to maneuver in the snow. It will slow things down, and it certainly increases the susceptibility of those cars being damaged by the snow that is thrown by the plows because it is so much of it and so heavy. Also today, all non-essential government functions are closed at the local level for the City of Lansing as well as the state, in addition to all the other closings that is doesn't happen very often throughout the region. And we will continue to provide updates. If people are interested, they can go to the City of Lansing's webpage, go to the public service webpage and draw down on the operations and maintenance web sheet, and it will provide people updates on where we're at plowing physically or in the city. And again, we're going to be starting here in the next hour or so and they can sign up for Nixle Alerts. There is a link on the webpage that will send a text message to people referencing a map saying we're in plow routes 2, 3, 4, 9, and 12, and we'll be entering, you know, routes 15, 17, and 19 later this morning, for example. So we want to make sure that our residents are communicated with, because as we move through the city, people want to have information. We want to be very responsive to our customers.
What advice do you have, Chad, for residents who have what they feel is important business that they need to attend to, who are inclined to venture out?
Well, certainly use caution, because there are a lot of pedestrians that unfortunately are walking in the streets.
Yes.
And we would certainly encourage people, although it's 15 inches of snow that they'll have to shovel or ask their neighbor with a Tim Allen-style snowblower to help them out with. But we certainly would ask people to begin clearing the snow from their sidewalks. The mayor has postponed the enforcement of the sidewalk ordinance for 48 hours so people can clear the snow. That is not to say that we're encouraging people to wait 48 hours, because it is so vitally important that people do that, because the snow is now so high at the street level that the pedestrians and certainly kids could be concealed by the snowbank. So please go out there, take your time doing it, but we encourage people to clear their sidewalks. I would also encourage people, if until they get to a major street, they should be fine. But certainly pack a shovel, pack some warm clothes, some mittens, obviously hat and gloves, because the temperature is dropping drastically, and we don't want them to get caught in a position where they might be in trouble.
Very good. We're going to learn more here from Dr. Joan Jackson Johnson in just a moment. Chad Gamble, we want to thank you. Chad is the City of Lansing COO and Director of Public Service. We wish you well. We'll stay in touch.
Thanks so much, Mark. Happy New Year.
Same to you. Well, let's turn now to Dr. Joan Jackson Johnson. Joan is the director of the Department of Human Relations and Community Services for the City of Lansing, and Joan coordinates food, shelter, and utility assistance programs for the needy. Joan, welcome back to Current State.
Thank you.
What's the current situation here then with regard to shelters in Lansing? I take it that is your highest priority?
My highest priority certainly is shelter, you know, safety issues for heat, food, basic needs. And our shelters are beyond their capacity, every last one, with the exception of a couple that would pose, serious challenges for the fire marshal. But all of the others are at capacity. Volunteers of America today, because it's the only day shelter that's open during the week, is above and beyond. In fact, we're getting ready to haul some extra chairs and a couple of tables over there, about 30 chairs.
How great a concern is that for you if these are already at capacity and we're looking at a couple of days of really frigid temperatures?
Well, what will happen, we probably have maxed out, and anyone else coming in, we will make alternative arrangements for them. Seniors in particular, or individuals with physical challenges, we will probably end up motelling.
Okay. And where are the existing shelters located, Joan?
The existing shelters, we have one in East Lansing, which is Haven House, and their capacity is 28, and they are at full capacity. They have 19 children. They don't have room for overflow. Again, safety and fire concerns would limit them. The Family Center, which is run by the Lansing City Rescue Mission in Lansing, have 90 women and children there at this time. The City Rescue Mission, which is on Michigan Avenue for men, their capacity is 50, and they have 9 over. Loaves and Fishes has capacity for 10, 6 men, 4 women, and they are 3 over, which means that we have people on air beds over there. Volunteers of America probably is the biggest challenge right now. They have capacity for 50 men, and we have 74. So there are 24 in the overflow in their day room sleeping on a cot.
Hmm.
In the women's shelter, there are capacity for 19, and there are 8 over in that area, again, sleeping in a different area. So we've had to bring in extra supervision, extra cots through emergency management, and there's a request today for extra chairs because you have people standing with no place to sit. Now, we always make sure that all doors are clear in case there's a fire or something, but we're using every corner of that building.
Is there anything
for
No, continue, please.
And they were, made the request for snacks, drinks, and some extra food over there, which we will get to them within the next hour or so.
Joan, is there anything the public at large can do, those of us whose lives are relatively under control here, to help your situation?
Well, I think the biggest challenge that I'm having right now is finding warm gloves, hats for adults and women in particular. Men gloves, larger sizes, we just can't find. Myers, Walmart's basically out of gloves. And we look, obviously, for something that's affordable for us, and looking for blankets for both Volunteers of America and the Mission, but both places need gloves. We also would love to have any snow pants, anyone that has lying around that's clean and gently used, hats for kids, gloves for kids as well. Our challenge the next couple of days is getting people from point A to B. And if individuals need shelter, if something has gone awry at home or if they're without food, they can call the non-emergency number at LPD if they don't have means to get to one of the shelters to secure food or just a warm place to be.
Okay, that's the non-emergency number at Lansing Police.
That's correct, or 211.
Or 211. I wanted to ask you about that. Has 211 been busy here during the ice storm and now after the snowstorm?
Well, 211 was so busy that I think they got to a point where their system was saturated and the resources dwindled. And what happened is that my number somehow was given out, and I, at one point, just thought I was ready to drop my phone in the dumpster or something. I didn't have all the answers, but we worked things out, and it certainly was a learning experience for all. We were able, the city, through our department, were able to assist the American Red Cross, and on Christmas morning, we do a normal brunch, my family, a ton of friends from the community, through donations, had a breakfast down there. We had over 2,000 people come in and out of Advent House that morning. The sad part, for a lot of people, we normally give out gifts. We didn't have enough, so the only persons that received anything were kids coming in. We just couldn't give out the hats, gloves, because we'd already used them.
Well, before we let you go, Joan, just remind us here, if someone does find themselves in need of shelter, where do they go? Do they go to one of the existing shelters that is already full and you will redirect them?
That's correct. Go to Volunteers of America on large, and we will make sure that they have a place to go.
Okay, and in the meantime, stocking caps and gloves where should people take those if they have them?
Volunteers of America also, or the City Rescue Commission.
Okay, very good. Joan Jackson Johnson is the director of the City of Lansing's Department of Human Relations and Community Services. Joan, good luck. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Also, we want to check out the situation here in East Lansing here today. East Lansing declared a snow emergency as well last night. We have East Lansing City Manager George Lahanas on the line to current state here this morning. Hi, George.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I am well. How are you faring today in East Lansing?
We're doing okay. You know, we've had quite a winter already, and it's only the beginning of January.
Yeah. Do you have any particular challenges here? I was lucky enough. I got a ride down Grand River about 6:45 this morning, and Grand River was really quite passable, quite drivable. Are you facing any particular challenges here, transportation or otherwise, here as we start the day?
By transportation, because we had such a huge volume of snow that what happened yesterday was our public works director, who's responsible for snow removal, was out looking at the state of the roads at that point and how snow was coming down, and said that they actually just needed people off the roads because people were becoming stuck at intersections, and that's making our jobs a lot more difficult getting the streets clear. So at that point, I requested to the mayor that we declare a state of emergency to make sure we could have people and give people direction to stay off the roads so we can get them cleared. We've made good progress. State trunk lines are generally clear. The major streets are generally clear. And we've probably gotten through a little less or about half the city in terms of local streets. So there's quite a bit of work left to do, and that will take the remainder of the day likely. And the other thing is that even though we've gotten these streets passable, we have to probably go back through and cut the banks back and move the snow back further. because it's sort of perhaps too narrow in a lot of areas.
It becomes a visibility issue at a lot of intersections, I think. And now, cold weather is a particular challenge. How concerned are you about the frigid weather here that's settling in?
Well, we hope that part of that direction that we gave out was information that people should stay indoors if at all possible. And hopefully people follow that because it is quite dangerous to be in that type of wind chill with that low a temperature. And, you know, obviously we can't make any people stay indoors, but it's just a recommendation and we hope people follow that. And also staying off the roads is very helpful, again, to allow the public service crews to do their work, but also emergency crews to do their work if there's any emergencies.
You know, I heard about Court 54A being closed today. Is 54B is closed, I presume, as well?
Correct. It's
okay.
All the operations that aren't essential. So City Hall, the court, our Parks and Recreation, community centers, public library are all closed today.
Okay, very good. And I know some number of East Lansing residents are served by the Lansing Board of Water and Light. I have to ask before we let you go, are you attending tomorrow night's BWL board meeting involving the utilities response to the ice storm?
Well, we're actually having our own city council meeting tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, so we have our own public meeting to attend, and we'll be discussing this issue at that point in terms of the city's response to that emergency. So we have work going on that night, so we'll be at our own meeting at 7 o'clock.
All right. Well, George, we appreciate your time here this morning to update the situation in East Lansing. George Lahanas is City of East Lansing City Manager. Thank you, George. Good luck.
Thank you.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. On January 5th, 1914, Henry Ford introduced a conditional $5-a-day wage for his assembly line workers. 100 years later, different people put different spins on that event. Some say it was Henry Ford paying his workers enough to buy the cars they were producing. Some say it was only a move to stop the high levels of worker turnover on the assembly lines. Here to look at these competing narratives and also to look at some interesting parallels 100 years on is MSU's John Beck. John's an associate professor in the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations at Michigan State University. Welcome back, John.
Great, Mark. Hope that all of you found a safe way to work this morning.
Well, we have one of the most disheveled-looking staffs that I've seen in an awful long time. I think we lead the media universe in hathead this morning. We had a couple of people spend the night at the station so they could be sure to be here this morning. But
thank you for your service that way.
Here's a quote from the Ford website I want to hit you with, John. In 1914, Henry Ford started an industrial revolution by more than doubling wages to $5 a day, a move that helped build the U.S. middle class and the modern economy. How accurate of a statement is that?
Well, I think that it's how it was perceived at the time and how it's perceived now are very, very different. So that I think that to a great degree that very well may be a correct statement now looking back, but I don't think that was Ford's intent. Many folks almost called him a socialist or a Marxist at the time because of this whole notion of you need to pay workers enough so that they can buy the thing that they produce. There were those who were quite against the move by his part. But Ford really comes out of a long line of kind of benevolent paternalists who believed that you could take certain actions as a captain of industry that had a, a strong effect on your business and maybe a strong effect on society as well. So that $5 a day wage came at a time when he had actually instituted the moving assembly line at Highland Park the year before, doubling productivity without doubling the workforce. In fact, the same amount of workers, double the productivity. But he was facing at that time between 300 and 400% turnover of his workforce. So it was something where turnover was very, very important to Ford's world. You just can't have it that you show up in the morning and you have to go out on the street and grab a whole new group of workers that you train to work the assembly line.
300 to 400%? That's I can't even comprehend that. 100% sounds bad enough. How does 300 to 400%?
Well, you can imagine that people were not used to moving assembly lines. I mean, the classic Chaplin film, Modern Times, mm-hmm. you know, has this hapless worker who ends up going through the gears of the machine and everything else.
Yeah.
And people simply weren't used to that kind of work pace. Most work was paced by the worker in terms of how much could he or she produce within X amount of time. Even in a piecework system, there was a good amount of actual discretion on the part of the worker as to how he or she got their work done. The minute that you go with machine pacing, it's no longer up to the worker to make the decision on how he or she is going to do their work. It's really up to the machine that defines the pace of work. And at times, actually, the actual nature of the work is defined by the machinery itself, which happened more and more over the decades since. Now, one thing about Ford, though, is that that kind of social engineering Ford, it wasn't only about turnover. It was about having, in his mind, a right workforce. So he wanted right attitudes at work, and he believed that right attitudes at work were absolutely linked to right attitudes at home. So when the wage is put in, this sees the real rise of what was called the Ford Sociological Department, where they were taking some of the, at that time, rise of social science and trying to apply it to factories. So they were going into homes to see whether or not your home was clean. Did you, you know, were you a sober individual? Did you have a good family life? And so part of the wage was not a wage. It was actually a profit-sharing check that came if, in effect, you checked out on those attitudes. Mm. And a lot of that, of course, could be, you know, quite in the eye of the beholder, depending on who was looking at what. The interesting thing in Michigan history, though, I mean, I think that a lot of your listeners might see that 1914, of course, is the closing months of the Michigan copper strike up in the UP.
Yes.
And so you get this drift of workers not only into kind of Western metal mining at that time because of the strike, but a good amount of people from the UP start moving down into the Ford factories. You get a good amount of people moving up from the South, both white and black. You get an increase in all of these folks coming in from Eastern and Southern Europe as well during that period before they cut off the kind of immigration taps. So this $5 a day, in some ways, is emblematic of kind of American prosperity. And, you know, America, a place where you can make a stake and all that. But, like I said, there were a lot of business leaders that were not that fond of what he was doing. But to get ready, I went on a few of the places like Forbes, Fortune, CNN's Marketplace website. And sure enough, all of them are using that same kind of, this created the middle class. Now, one thing to bear in mind is that this ran smack dab into World War One in only a matter of months after it was introduced. So a few years into its introduction, World War One hits, and you get hyperinflation. You also get people being siphoned off to the war industries or whatever. So you get kind of a change in what Ford is doing with the $5 a day. Because of that whole kind of change. The other change, though, Mark, that's real interesting is that what he was doing is he was instituting $5 a day for 8 hours of work rather than 9 hours of work. So it wasn't only that he was increasing the wage, he was actually reducing the workday.
Okay.
So in that way, it truly was a wage increase because of the fact that people were able to make in 8 hours what they used to make in nine, except that they had this additional kicker of all this money coming in from the from living right, according to Henry Ford's standards.
Was $5 a day a living wage in 1914 in the way that we refer to a living wage today?
No, actually, I think it was actually quite good by comparison. So it is true that you get people who advance quite dramatically based on that specific wage. You know, Detroit ends up, after World War II, having, I think, the highest amount of home ownership anywhere in the United States. All of that really a credit to the American auto industry for the most part. So you get a kind of a strong march to what we would regard kind of middle-class life. Now, does that all pivot on Henry Ford's decision on the $5 day? No. It pivots on the fact that this is an unbelievably important industry that ended up making huge profits for Ford, GM, Chrysler, and the rest. And a lot of those profits were passed along to workers in the form of wage increases, especially after unionization starting in the 1930s. Now, one thing that this did do, it staunched an interest in unionization at Ford in the teens. The first sit-down strike is not actually at General Motors. The first sit-down strike is in 1915 at Studebaker in Ohio, or Indiana, I can't remember which. But what you get is this rise of industrial unions, the Industrial Workers of the World, and others who are very interested in unionizing auto, as are a lot of the kind of skilled trade unions at the time. So this $5 day plots the rise of the sociological department that ends up being staffed by thugs later, Perry Bennett and the Service Bureau. Those guys end up being able to keep unionization away from Ford until the 1940s.
But are you saying that the Studebaker strike, was that a result of... Was that related to Ford's increasing their wages? Did they suddenly feel like they were being shortchanged?
I'm not sure. I haven't looked at the Studebaker strike to see if there was that kind of cause and effect. But what you have is a strong interest in unionization that's rising across the United States. Naturally, Detroit would be a place where you would expect that would find expression. And what is true is that the $5 a day virtually kind of dissipated that interest at Ford for years and years to come, along with other factors. Now, just one last thing to say about Ford, just because Ford really was an unbelievably complex man. You know, he's rated as one of the top 10 bigots of all time on one website because of his anti-Semitism. But this is a guy that, on top of the $5 a day wage, on top of the Model T and Model A, you know, he creates on the Rouge really strong vertical integration, making everything under one roof, for the most part, for the cars. 100,000 people at the Rouge at one point or another. But this is the same guy who sentimentally sets up Village Industries across Michigan, where there are small batch production, often involving women, where they have water wheels and everything else. They almost look like small parks rather than industrial facilities. So he was a very, very, very complex man. And the $5 a day, I think, probably catapulted him to the forefront of American business thinking, even past what the Model T and Model A had done, only because of the fact that he... was trying to actually make decisions as a social engineer, as a captain of industry. There were a lot of other competing car brands at the time, and I think that this was his real strong step into modern American management with the $5 a day.
So 100 years on, here just briefly to wrap up, John, 100 years later then, are young people today facing parallels similar to 100 years ago?
Well, one thing that's real interesting to me about the parallelism is that Around that time, you weren't likely to have a regular job. You were likely to be a casual. You might work in an auto plant for a while, not like it, jump to another auto plant or jump to a brewery or jump to, you know, some other kind of retail operation. So what's really interesting is that these folks in 1914 didn't have a lot of job security. They didn't have benefits. They didn't have a variety of things that we've come to look at as the kind of the standard of what constitutes kind of an American career as an American worker. And I think that we're beginning to see that again, but some of it is because of the fact that young people can't necessarily find work, but some of it is because of the fact that many of them now believe that kind of I am the sum of my projects, my office is actually Starbucks, that kind of notion. You're seeing kind of a rise of folks who actually like the casualization by comparison to locking into one career, one workplace their entire life. So it's kind of funny how far we've come and how what used to be regarded as not a good situation by some is regarded as something that they seek out.
Talking of a legendary day, 100 years ago yesterday, the introduction of the $5 workday by Henry Ford. Our guest has been John Beck, associate professor in the School of MSU School of Human Resources and Labor Relations. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Mark.
And now for a current state public poetry announcement. Snow Day by Billy Collins. Today we woke up to a revolution of snow, its white flag waving over everything. The landscape vanished, not a single mouse to punctuate the blankness. And beyond these windows, the government buildings smothered, schools and libraries buried, the post office lost under the noiseless drift, the paths of trains softly blocked, the world fallen under this falling. In a while, I will put on some boots and step out like someone walking in water, and the dog will porpoise through the drifts, and I will shake a laden branch, sending a cold shower down on us both. But for now, I'm a willing prisoner in this house, a sympathizer with the anarchic cause of snow. I will make a pot of tea and listen to the plastic radio on the counter, as glad as anyone to hear the news that the Kitty Corner School is closed, the Ding Dong School closed, the All Aboard Children's School closed, the Hi-Ho Nursery School closed, along with, some will be delighted to hear, the Toadstool School, the Little School, Little Sparrows Nursery School, Little Stars Preschool, Peas and Carrots Day School, the Tom Thumb Child Center, all closed, and, clap your hands, the Peanuts Play School. So this is where the children hide all day. These are the nests where they letter and draw, where they put on their bright miniature jackets, all darting and climbing and sliding, all but the few girls whispering by the fence. And now I'm listening hard in the grandiose silence of the snow, trying to hear what those three girls are plotting, what riot is afoot, which small queen is about to be brought down. Billy Collins, Snow Day. Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Here in East Lansing, we're blessed by a very unique institution here at Michigan State University, the Vincent Voice Library. It is a treasure trove of historic audio recordings, tens of thousands of them, and current state's Peter Worf is along to tell us more about the Vincent Voice Library. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me with you today. Of course, being an audio guy, you know something about the G. Robert Vincent Voice Library.
Yes.
Like you said, a collection of about, actually more than 40,000 hours of spoken word recordings dating back to 1888, you know, the days of the Edison cylinder.
Mm.
The collection includes the voices of over 100,000 people from all walks of life, from presidents to everyday people, cultural leaders to players in the human drama, arts, and just about everything you can imagine. Now, this collection was started by its namesake, G. Robert Vinson, who we'll learn more about, from current State Museum Supervisor John Shaw. I got together with him a couple of months ago to have this extended conversation. We'll hear part of it now. We'll also hear about longtime museum head Morris Crane, who led that museum for quite a long time. Yeah. But first, an introduction to Vincent himself from John Shaw.
He became fascinated with sound recording in 1912, actually. He was either born in 1898 or 1900, depending on whether you believe him or some of the other sources. We weren't sure, but I think he probably 1900. And in 1912, when he was very young then, probably 12 or 14, he actually recorded Teddy Roosevelt at Roosevelt's home in Oyster Bay in Long Island. This was a fascinating thing. Bob knew the Edison family. He later worked in Edison Labs. And he borrowed a cylinder recorder from Charles Edison, Thomas Edison's son, and he and some other boys drove to Oyster Bay in a Model T Ford, and they kind of stormed into the house and through their perseverance actually got TR to be recorded.
And as good citizens, in the same way, I'd expect any one of you to act in a football game. In other words, don't flinch, don't foul, and hit the line hard.
That really shaped Bob's life after that. I mean, this was a thing he was fascinated with. And he was born in a time when sound recording was still very, very new. He essentially ran away from home as a young man and had adventures. He was in World War I as a dispatch driver, and also in World War II as a army officer. And all the time he was doing these things, he was recording and collecting recordings. As I said, he later worked in Edison Labs, and he had a title. It was Phonograph Assistant to Mr. Edison, which is a strange title in and of itself. But he worked in the labs, and he later, one of the early things he acquired was a collection of cylinder recordings, which he got from the Edison family. And he worked to develop filtering devices to transfer the cylinders to tape later on.
Yeah, John, talk about this early format that he would have used when he burst in on TR or made some of these early recordings.
Yeah, Edison invents the phonograph in 1877. And in its first incarnation, it's very, very primitive. What you have is essentially a stylus on a piece of tinfoil. It was literally that.
After these early recordings, what's next after the war and this interest in recording voices?
What happens is he's very successful in the war. Successful is a strange term to use, but he worked in he was one of the creators of the V-Disc program during the war, and this was a huge deal. They actually sent recordings of popular music on unbreakable discs, sent them overseas for morale. So soldiers would get really up-to-date popular music. And what Bob did, one of the things he did, is broker a deal between the unions and the army, essentially, to create these discs. And they would create programming, especially to send overseas. And Bob really got the V-Disc program off the ground. And he was also often known as V-Disc Vincent. It's a huge deal.
Hi, man. This is Frank Sinatra. I hope you like these tunes that I've chosen to do for you on these very wonderful V-Discs. And I hope that you get as much a kick out of hearing him as I do out of singing him for you.
After the war, he was always trying. He ran a recording studio in Radio City for many years. He knew a lot of people, and he did different things. He's always building the collection, so he's acquiring it all the times. Technically, what happens after the war is we have recording tape, and that was a huge deal. Invented in Germany, brought to the United States after the war, and dominated recording for the next 50 years. Tape was very economic, very easy to use, and very high quality, very high fidelity.
When does the library start to take shape and begin to resemble something like what we see now at Michigan State University?
Well, what happens, Bob continues on his career, and in the early 60s, he's doing different things. He's living in California. He never could quite get it to be what he wanted to be in terms of what the collection was going to be. He wanted to go to Yale. Yale was not really interested. And in 1962, when Bob would have been somewhere about 62, 64 years old, he spoke to then director of libraries, MSU Libraries, Dr. Richard Chapin. And Chapin essentially brought Bob and the collection to Michigan State University. This was in 1962. So Bob had called it different things. He'd run it essentially as a private library. He called it the National Vocarium for many years. He brought it to Michigan State, and it became the National Voice Library. Okay. He got quarters on the fourth floor of the library, where we're still at. And one of the first things he did was convert everything to tape, to make it more usable and also for preservation. So he's spending a lot of time recording from cylinders and discs, et cetera, essentially re-recording or carrying the voices through time. He also did off-air recordings. He had a recording studio, brought people in, similar to what we do now. And a lot of trading relationships and gifts are always coming in, too. So what happens most importantly is the materials are cataloged. And in the library world, this is an incredibly important thing. This is how you find things. So a bibliographic record is information about information, what we call metadata in modern life. So what happens is Bob's essentially private collection is cataloged, and it exists on catalog cards within the library, and a dictionary catalog, essentially a bound reproduction of the catalog cards, is created. And so now everyone around the world knows what Michigan State University has, the National Voice Library. Bob retires in 1973. And then in 1974, Dr. Maurice A. Crane becomes the new head of what is now called the G. Robert Vincent Voice Library in Bob's honor.
We always divide people into sayers and doers. But in our generation, my generation, all of the doers were also sayers. Mussolini and Hitler and Stalin and Churchill and Roosevelt, because they all knew that saying was an important part of doing. They were all charismatic figures.
The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Dr. Crane came to MSU in 1953. He was a professor of humanities, later a distinguished professor. And he actually worked with Bob in radio. They did a program on the old mutual broadcasting called Spin Back the Years. So Dr. Crane knew Bob. They did radio shows together, and he was a logical choice to be head of the Voice Library when Bob retired. So we have a new person in place. Maury Crane is many, many things. A brilliant man, a scholar, intellectual, and also a show business guy. Many of your listeners will know him as head of the Geriatric 6+1, the faculty jazz band that played at MSU football games forever. So Dr. Crane, what he brings to it is an intellectualism that adds to it. So the kind of things that we choose are different then. It becomes the breadth of knowledge. There's no limit to what he will record. And also, he's a voracious collector. I believe that in his time at the Voice Library, he finally retired in 2000, he probably recorded enough analog tape to stretch from East Lansing to San Francisco. He certainly did. So the collection, by the time of his retirement, has increased by 30 times at least.
John, let's talk a little bit about the user experience at the library. How can people interact and actually draw from the vast collection in different ways?
Well, anyone can come in and I will play anything that we have. So that's really the main line of use there. Things are accessible within the library. We put online everything that we can. And the designation there is copyright. So what your listeners don't probably, many of your listeners will not understand is that things go up on the internet that shouldn't be there.
Right.
Okay. The university and the Michigan State University Libraries has a very healthy respect, and rightly so, for copyright law. So we're only going to put up online things that are held in the public domain or things which we have permissions for, and we work on permissions all the time. We serve scholars around the world, again, who are writing papers that they're coming to us because they can't get the information any other way, or they want to interpret what is said in the past by listening to it. And again, that's we feel is our mission. We also have another a niche really that we've done is providing sound actualities to production companies, radio and television networks, and now internet producers around the world. So what we'll do then is people are doing research, like say Ken Burns, and they want to, he's doing something on say the Civil War, and not a lot of film and recording from the Civil War, none, for example, but you can run photographs with a voiceover, and you can put a sound or a person's voice over the top of it, and they do that a lot. We have sent things to Ken Burns, we have sent things to George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, NBC, ABC, NBC, all the major networks. Another niche that in recent years, which is interesting, is providing actors with examples of sound recordings of famous people. And they do this for study. Okay, the most recent one was for Leonardo DiCaprio in the movie The Aviator, who he portrays Howard Hughes. So we sent his production people. I don't talk to the stars. I talk to the third or fourth production person in the line.
He's got, you know, people.
Right. He's got people, right. I once got a call from somebody's production assistant. They were driving in a convertible in Buenos Aires, and they were on the phone to me in East Lansing wanting to know if they could get such and such a recording. That was, I always tell that story.
Cigarette?
Oh, no. Thanks. I don't smoke. Boy, you are just hitting on all six cylinders, aren't you? My God. Would you do me a favor? Would you just smile for me one time? Just once. Yeah, yeah. You see, you got a short upper lip. Makes for a much nicer smile. See, I wonder what gives a beautiful woman like you pleasure.
So this was a search for the voice of Howard Hughes.
Yes, right.
How he said things.
Exactly. How does he sound? And you watch the movie, and he sounds like Howard Hughes. Well, we assume, since I sent the recordings, he listened to our recordings to learn to speak like Howard Hughes.
John Shaw of the Vincent Voice Library here at Michigan State University. John, thanks for sharing this rich sound history with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Peter. I really appreciate it. It's been great.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
This is an acrostic Spenserian sonnet written May 4th, 1941 by Ralph Dighton Jackson to Bob Vincent. If you listen carefully, you'll hear his name spelled out in the first letters of each line. Recording, you recall the figures past or soon to pass from this their temporal earth. Bequeath the generations with a vast, enriching gift, a heritage of worth. Recording now, you take in hand the mirth, the tears, and searchings of our present span. Validify our wisdom's death and birth. Immortalize our passing life's dim plan.
A reminder that you can follow Current State on Twitter at KAR Current State. Feedback always welcome via email at currentstate@wkar.org. Also, the latest storm-related information is also at wkar.org. That's our show for today. Coming up Tuesday on Current State, we speak with leaders from the Michigan Conservative Energy Forum. Also, a Detroit-based photographer explores video game culture in Nigeria. We'll learn about his project, Lagos Gaming, tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of our program is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks also to producers Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl, as well as to Aaron Young for engineering and Gabriella Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're going to leave you today with a classic from Billie Holiday, perfect for this very wintry day. We hope you stay safe and have a good day. We'll see you tomorrow.
Snow is snowing, the wind is blowing, but I can weather the storm. What do I care how much it may storm? I've got my love to keep me warm. Remember a worse December. Just watch those icicles.